The court will now hear arguments in the case of State of Buckeye v. Kat Hood, petitioner. Counsel, you may begin your arguments.
My name is Rachel Leach, and I will be arguing the constitutional question for the appellant. I would also like to reserve 2 minutes for my co-counsel to give rebuttal, and their code is D1.
Your code is D or theirs is D?
My code is D2, and their code is D1. Your Honors, may it please the court. In order to uphold the Fourth Amendment in cases of stop and frisk, Terry v. Ohio establishes the standard of reasonable suspicion that must be met. There's no strict test to determine whether reasonable suspicion exists, so Mame v. Wisner, citing United States v. Courts, explains that courts should consider, quote, the totality of the circumstances. In this case, a police officer heard shouts in a crowded food court saying, quote, "Cat's smelling like booze and looking dangerous in that leather. She's packing in that bag, count on it."
Can you move that mic a little bit closer so more people can hear you?
Thank you. The question today is whether these shouts in the given context provided sufficient reasonable suspicion for the officer to search Kat's bag. Through analyzing first the type of informant, second the content of the tip, and finally the context of the tip, it is clear that no such reasonable suspicion existed. The shouts the officer heard should not even be considered an informant. First, the person shouting did not seek out an officer to inform. The officer can't even be sure that they knew a police officer would hear them shouting at all. The officer didn't know their intentions. They could have been taunting Kat or making a joke. This should shape how the officer viewed the shouts. If they can't be sure if the person is even being serious, they cannot use these shouts as a basis for reasonable suspicion.
But isn't that sort of endemic to the role of a police officer to be looking for things that might be affecting public safety? And so wouldn't a shout be good enough?
Yes, so of course the role of the police officer is to protect public safety, but we would argue that this tip or shouts did not have enough indicia of reliability for a multitude of reasons, including the fact that a police officer was not directly sought out. But beyond that, even though it is the role of the police to protect public safety, the police also have an obligation as agents of the government to uphold the Fourth Amendment and to not make unreasonable searches and seizures if they don't have probable cause, which is why...
What would you have a police officer do? This is a crowded area with a lot of high school students. We know that there have been mass shootings. What would you have a police officer do? Wouldn't you rather that a police officer make sure that all the students are safe in a circumstance like this?
Obviously, that is one role of police, but the police have many roles, and one of them is adhering to the Constitution. So in this case, a simple thing the police officer could have done is gone and sought out the person who shouted the tip and asked them to clarify and gotten more information from them, because with just the information they had, that wasn't enough. But if they weren't going to follow up, they should have done more independent investigating, which I will get to later. But essentially, the investigating that the police officer did was just confronting Kat. But that created a self-fulfilling prophecy, as Kat was a teenager who was intimidated by this police officer, and her looking nervous was just a natural reaction based on that intimidation and can't be considered independent investigation or independent corroboration because the cop created the scenario that made Kat look nervous in the first place.
Counsel, why is the corroboration of the accuracy of that she did smell of alcohol and she was dressed in the same manner and that was her name? Why is that not sufficient corroboration for the tip that was made?
So the tip and the corroboration only relate to characteristics that are readily observable. It doesn't give any inside information on knowledge of the crime. If we turn to the Supreme Court case of Florida v. J.L., we can see that they rule that essentially just being able to accurately identify an individual does not mean that the tip is credible in its assertion of illegality. So to define that, it's essentially the tip doesn't show that the tipster has knowledge that anything illegal is happening. So just because the police officer was able to corroborate things that are visually observable does not mean that they can be certain or even like likely believe that the person giving the tip actually knew that Kat was committing a crime.
Wouldn't have been consuming alcohol at 18 and not 21 been that would be a crime, and wouldn't that be sufficient?
So I would say that first, the police officer couldn't know that Kat was 21 since they did not ask for ID. But beyond that, it is clear from the language that the cop was using that their search was for a weapon, not for alcohol, because before the second time that they demanded Kat dump out her bag, they said something along the lines of, "To me, packing means a weapon." and then they demanded that she dump out her bag, meaning the search was not for alcohol, it was for a weapon. But beyond that, Kat actually explained why she smelled like alcohol, and it was because of her leather jacket. So all of these things mean that the cop wasn't even searching for alcohol, but if they were, they also didn't have reasonable suspicion for that because they did not know Kat's age.
Now, counsel, I have a brief question just to frame your argument to understand it. Under the case of City of Maumee versus Wiesner, we're told that there are three different types of informants: the known and identified informant, the corroborative informant, who often tends to be like a potential co-conspirator, and then the third is the unidentified anonymous. Now, here we have kind of a hybrid situation where the informer remained in the room, and the policeman could have asked her name, but did not. So are we looking at this as anonymous?
Thank you, Your
Honor. Or are we looking at it as an informant capable of being known, even though the police officer made no effort to find out?
I would argue that we should turn to case law to address this gray area between an identified citizen informant and an anonymous informant. And so when there's gray area, State v. Cisternino outlines that important factors to consider are face-to-face contact or the police definitively being able to identify the person who is making this accusation. None of these things are really met in this case because the person who was shouting in this food court, they could have run away. They could have blended in with the crowd. And I think really importantly, if the police officer actually went up and asked them, they could have just taken back what they said. They could have said they were joking or taunting Kat or not being serious. So ultimately, we can't count this as anything other than an anonymous informant because we don't have this crucial information about them, such as like face-to-face contact or being able to identify them in the future. And this really goes to the issue of criminal liability and accountability, which are super important things in making sure that basically tips are reliable. If the person giving the tip can't be held accountable for saying false things, then the reliability of that tip goes down considerably. So regardless of if you consider them identified because they're in the same room, which obviously we argue you shouldn't, you still have to give them a very low degree of reliability because we can't be certain that they knew they would be held accountable. So even if, in the abstract, hypothetically, they could have been held accountable, the fact that the person giving the tip didn't know that they could be held accountable and the cop knew that they didn't know they could be held accountable, we can't trust the tip. Or rather, the cop in that situation couldn't have trusted the tip as a basis for reasonable suspicion.
So that would have taken more corroborative
follow-up.
What about in Tidwell? In that case, the police officer didn't do anything to interrogate the tipster, and there was no effort to hold that individual accountable or even identify that individual. And so here, yeah, maybe it was shouted, but why is this not the same as Tidwell?
So we would argue that issues such as independent investigation, as well as, I think crucially, my first point, that this person wasn't even intending to be an informant at all, should make the cop, I guess, less able to be reliant on the tip. But moving now to the actual content of the tip, the Supreme Court case Alabama v. White explains that in determining the reliability of a tip, what was important was the caller's ability to predict the respondent's future behavior because it demonstrated inside information, a special familiarity with the respondent's affairs. So again, circling back to the argument I was making earlier, in this case today, the tip did not predict anything that would happen in the future. It simply identified characteristics that are readily observable. And when we turn to a fairly similar case to the one that we have here today, another Supreme Court case, Florida v. J.L., we can see that an accurate description of a subject's readily observable location and appearance is, of course, reliable in this limited sense. It will help the police correctly identify the person whom the tipster means to accuse. Such a tip, however, does not show that the tipster has knowledge of concealed criminal activity. So the important thing out of this is knowledge of concealed criminal activity. That's what the tip actually needs to give the officer in order for there to be reasonable suspicion. A tip can correctly identify someone. A tip can name someone. But because we don't know that the tip being able to do those things means that a crime is happening, we can't have reasonable suspicion.
So just the usual definition of prediction you're saying in this case doesn't really apply because there was a prediction that she was packing and there was an object found in there. So isn't it arguable that the prediction came true?
So the reasonableness of official of like reasonable suspicion, according to Florida VJL, needs to be based on what the officer knew before they made the search. So we can't have this after the fact justification that says that because this came true, they had reasonable suspicion. Instead, the officer needs to have that reasonable suspicion before they make the stop and search. So they would have had to have access to predictive information about Kat before the search.
Well, or they did have some predictive information, not necessarily for the weapon, but the tip was that Kat's smelling like booze, a prediction, and then the policeman walks over and in fact finds that Kat Hood smelled like alcohol. Does that then provide enough predictive authority to say you qualified under that first one of smelling like alcohol? Now I want to check to see if she is packing, which it's reasonable to assume meaning packing a weapon.
Right. So we would argue that smelling like booze is a readily observable characteristic that you could notice by just walking by Kat. And because, again, we don't know that Kat is 21, her smelling like alcohol is not a crime at all. So it's not predictive information. It's rather information that shows that the tipster can, yes, identify Kat. We don't disagree that the tipster identified Kat, clearly. They used her name. What the tipster did not do is show the police officer that they had any inside knowledge of a crime that was actually being committed. And because the police officer couldn't know that this person knew about a crime, then they could not use their tip, again, as a basis for reasonable suspicion in this case. So we would argue that that's not predictive information that shows the officer that they're going to commit a crime. It's rather something that they could have observed.
Is there any issue to her giving consent?
So I would argue that in that circumstance, we all know she is an 18-year-old, and this is a police officer. The police officer demanded not once but twice for her to dump out her bag and said that he was not asking. So those demands mean, especially given the context that she is very young, the power differential means that she didn't have any option to not dump out her bag. We don't know what would have happened if she did not dump out her bag, but neither did Kat, and that could put her in a very precarious situation. So I would argue that there really wasn't any consent to her dumping out her bag due to like the circumstances that she was under. Finally, let's move to considering the context of these shouts. The Supreme Court in Mame v. Wisner explains that the informant's motivations support the reliability of his tip in that case. But in this case, the informant's likely motivations go against the reliability of the tip. If we look to the language they use, they were likely taunting Kat. I mean, they said she was looking dangerous in that leather. That's not language that's accusing her of a crime. It's language that's taunting her, and it would be completely irrelevant to a serious criminal tip that is actually going to a police officer. Now moving on to, I briefly addressed this earlier, but I wanted to circle back, the follow-up that the police officer made. What opposing counsel will likely argue is independent investigation that justified this stop and frisk. I would argue, again, that this was a self-fulfilling prophecy entirely. The police officer confronted and intimidated Kat. That is a likely reaction from anyone, regardless of if they are committing crime. So the fact that she had that reaction does not mean that she was likely to commit a crime. And again, we need to look not to Kat's reaction, but to what the police officer knew. The standard of reasonable suspicion is whether the police officer had reasonable suspicion. So because there are many circumstances other than someone carrying a gun in which a police officer confronting someone would lead to them having this reaction, the police officer can't use that reaction, which would happen in a multitude of circumstances, to justify this very specific search for a weapon.
Well, following on like Terry, would you say it would have been okay for the police officer to do somewhat of like a pat-down search of the bag?
So, for a weapon? Your Honor, we have waived questioning whether or not the police officer needed a warrant. So we agree that this...
No, not for a warrant.
Right.
Meaning like a search that was less intrusive than dump your bag.
So we agree that both of those things would be considered a stop and frisk. So I would argue that the officer would need less suspicion, arguably, to do that. But I would also argue that in this case, that would still... Basically, the officer would not have reasonable suspicion to do that either. No.
Is there anything the officer could do? I think you would acknowledge that police officer safety is legitimate interest. So within your framework, how could the officer in this circumstance ensure his safety and ensure that she wasn't a threat to him? What would be constitutionally permissible?
Right. So I think in general, obviously, police officers are trained to handle this type of situation. I think that they should take the precautions outside of this like dangerous situation to have the adequate training. But I think ultimately, and I will circle back to your question, sorry, but the Fourth Amendment needs to be protected by police officers. They cannot value personal safety above that. But I would also say that the officer should have used context clues. I mean, Kat wasn't necessarily reaching into her bag. So when he was confronting her, there was no like immediate need for a stop. In fact, he could have just confiscated her bag and not searched through it. There are many other precautions that he could have taken. I would also argue that from the shouts, there wasn't any legitimate risk of an immediate security threat. The person didn't even accuse Kat of planning on using the weapon. They just said that she was possessing it. That is, if we buy that packing obviously means a weapon, which I would also call into question.
Counsel, you mentioned that there was lots of reasons why Ms. Hood would have that reaction, but what would be a valid non-criminal reason for her to act so, I guess, suspicious or not intimidated, but wanting to hold her bag really tightly?
I would say that that's just a natural reaction to her being confronted, and I would also circle back to the argument that it's not a question of what Kat was doing, but rather what the police officer should have known at that time. And the police officer should have known that by confronting someone, they're naturally going to have a reaction of being scared. I ran out of time, but may I just make a quick concluding statement?
Yes, go ahead.
The Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable searches and seizures can only exist if a remedy is provided when such a right is violated. Because of this, because the crossbow was found in an unconstitutional search, we ask that you reverse and remand the decision of the Buckeye Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you.
May I proceed, Your Honors?
Yes.
Before I start, I'd like to introduce myself again. My name is Eliza Wunderlich. My individual code is D1, and I will be arguing the statutory question for the appellant. Madam Chief Justice, Your Honors, may it please the court. Based on the stipulated factual record, the appellant's carrying of her 4-inch novelty crossbow does not violate Buckeye's concealed carry statute. This statute, BC 29-23-12, states that no person shall knowingly carry or have concealed on the person's person or concealed ready at hand any of the following: 1, a deadly weapon other than a handgun; 2, a handgun other than a deadly ordnance; or 3, a deadly ordnance. Ms. Hood did not violate the statute for two reasons. 1, the crossbow was not ready at hand. And 2, the crossbow does not meet the requirements for a deadly weapon. Firstly, we argue that the crossbow was not ready at hand. Ohio Supreme Court case State v. Miller, as cited within State v. Davis, defines ready at hand as, quote, so near as to be conveniently accessible and within immediate reach. State v. Higgins further clarifies when they upheld a concealed weapons conviction because the weapon could be used, quote, simply by opening the bag, removing the weapon, and loading it. Now, in Higgins, the aforementioned bag, was a gun case containing only a gun and ammunition. It was very easy to reach in the bag, put both pieces together, and make the weapon operable.
Is it fair for us to assume that we're not really dealing with deadly ordnance, which I recall under the statute are things like grenade launchers?
Yes, we are here today dealing with whether or not it's a deadly weapon other than a handgun, which would be the first prong of that.
But she could have just, this was an open shoulder bag, and she could have reached in it very quickly, could she not? How is that not ready at hand?
Well, I would say that we are contrasting Higgins here because the appellant's bag contained a lot of different items, including multiple packs of gum, lip balm, brushes, notes, pens, and some crumpled up dollar bills. She would have to reach in, find the quirl and the crossbow, which were two separate entities, put them together for the crossbow to even be operable.
But didn't she know where it was? I mean, she felt it in her back. She realized that she had it on her. And so it would be easy to grab in because she knew exactly where the crossbow was.
Well, she felt it against her leg, yes. It would still require looking in the bag and digging to the bottom to be able to actually find it. Furthermore, in State v. Anderson, it was held that a knife was not a deadly weapon because it was different from knives used in violent crime. These knives used in violent crime had the potential for, quote, instant one-handed operation. Ms. Hood's crossbow does not meet this standard, as it would require two hands to find both these pieces, put them together, and be able to fire the crossbow or make it operable.
I was going to say, wouldn't that be the same for a handgun? You have to have two hands to be able to load a magazine, and then it takes obviously one hand to fire, but so did this crossbow. So it takes two hands to assemble it to get it out of the bag, just the same as a firearm.
Yes, but a firearm is specifically designed to be a weapon. Ms. Hood's crossbow is not designed to be a weapon. In fact, it does not qualify as a deadly weapon at all.
Before we move on to the deadly weapon question, I have a ready at hand question. As I read the affirmative defenses, they both also say that it has to be carried ready at hand. So since you're arguing that this is not ready at hand, are you forswearing any reliance on the affirmative defenses in this case?
Yes, I would be. I'd like to move on now to the deadly weapon statute. Buckeye's deadly weapon statute states, that's BC 292311, Section A, that a deadly weapon means any instrument, device, or thing capable of inflicting death and designed or specifically adapted for use as a weapon or possessed, carried, or used as a weapon. This statute is an either-or statement, meaning that to be held as a deadly weapon, it would need to be capable of inflicting death and either designed or specifically adapted for use as a weapon, or possessed, carried, or used as a weapon.
Is that a subject or an objective question? Are we to look to whether Kat specifically had this in her handbag with potential use for a weapon, or do we look at the objective factors about someone carrying a metal crossbow with arrows that could embed themselves in a fence deeply as weapon intent? Do we look to her specific intent or the average person's intent to determine that?
I would say, Your Honor, in this case, we would have to look to her specific intent and the specific context of why she had the crossbow, where she got the crossbow, things of that nature.
Another part of the statute that's bothering me, Counselor, is the word capable, and it's going off what Justice Sotolo just said. If this object could shoot steel-tipped arrows, small ones, albeit small ones, into a fence, think of what they could do to a human body. Are you saying that, therefore, it is not capable of inflicting death?
Whether it is capable of inflicting death itself is, in this case, not relevant, as we are arguing the last two prongs. We could argue that even if it was capable of inflicting death, if it does not meet either of the other standards met by, required by the statute, then it still would not qualify as a deadly weapon, even if it was capable of inflicting death.
Counsel, are you conceding then that it qualifies as is an object that can inflict death?
I would say the object itself, I would say the stipulated factual record does not hold a definitive position in either way.
You just said it was irrelevant for our analysis, so that would mean that we have to assume then you're not arguing against that.
Well, I will not be arguing against that, no, as even if it was, it's not necessarily make it a deadly weapon under BC 292311. We argue that clearly the crossbow was not designed or specifically adapted for use as a weapon. The crossbow was merely 4 inches long, which is a far cry from a normal crossbow that would be used for, say, hunting.
So also, the metal spikes were how long?
I believe they were about the size of the crossbow, so 3 or 4 inches, Your Honor.
And were they packaged inside the backpack?
I believe there was at least one loose quarrel inside the bag. The packaging also described this toy as a, quote, terrific novelty, which is not something that would really be used to describe a manufactured weapon.
We have cases that are saying that you can use a pin for a weapon that can qualify under deadly weapon. So just because a manufacturer is saying, trying to sell it as a novelty instead of selling it as a weapon, can't you look at what it is capable of doing and determine that it was designed as a potential weapon?
Well, in the case of the ballpoint pen being certified as a deadly weapon, that was State v. Coburn, and it was certified as a deadly weapon taking into account the actions of the user of the pen and also the intent of the user. And Katz's actions and intent did not match with the actions and intent of this case, and so we would argue that it's not comparable.
So what would you say her intent was in carrying this item?
I would say her intent was as a teenager excited with their 18th birthday gift, and she said that she wanted to show it to her friend. But once she put it in her bag, she actually forgot about it for a week until the night of the game. So I would say the only intent with her carrying the crossbow was just to show her friends. It's also stipulated that Ms. Hood did not modify the crossbow, again, going back to it not being specifically adapted for use as a weapon. We can contrast this with cases like State v. Coburn or State v. Huber, where a mop was certified as a deadly weapon, but only because the end of it was sharpened and therefore modified, which is why it qualified under this statute. Next, I will argue that Ms. Hood never possessed, carried, or used the crossbow as a weapon. Now, she had only had it for a week at the time of the search and seizure, and in that time, it was only shot a few times. It was shot at balloons at a birthday party, and then was also shot at her backyard fence. She put it in her bag, again, with the intent of showing her best friend her new toy that she had gotten for her birthday.
Didn't she also have the thought that she could use it against muggers? Because she walked home late at night from time to time.
Well, we would argue that she did not have that intent, as that comment about a mugger, she stated that she thought it would make a mugger laugh, clearly stating that she had no intent of actually using it for self-defense, as if she did, it wouldn't help her at all. It would just make the mugger laugh. In State v. King, it was held that the statute itself does not make mere possession of an otherwise lawful item illegal. This novelty crossbow, a toy that Ms. Hood received for her birthday, was not in itself illegal. And so the statute does not make this lawful item.
Was that the case of the straight razor?
Yes, that was, Your Honor. It does not necessarily make her having this concealed toy in her bag illegal. It does not make it a deadly weapon. It does not make it ready at hand or any of these things.
But doesn't the fact that it could kill someone if you shot them with it, isn't that just in and of itself a deadly weapon? That's what a gun, if you shoot someone with it, it kills them. A knife, if you stab someone with them, it kills them. You're not going to, no one legitimately is going to argue that a gun or a 4-inch knife isn't a deadly weapon. So why isn't a crossbow with a 3 to 4 inch bolt a deadly weapon?
Well, again, going back to the statute, all of those cases you mentioned, Your Honor, they did have the potential, they were capable of inflicting death, but they also met one of the other prongs, whether that was specifically designed or adapted as a weapon, like a gun is definitely designed as a weapon. Some knives are specifically adapted to be more suitable for violent crime. And it was also, again, it could have been possessed, carried, or used as a weapon. In this case, Ms. Hood did not possess, carry, or use her crossbow as a weapon, and it was not specifically designed or modified in any way.
Are you arguing that it couldn't be used as a weapon? I mean, we see that these steel-tipped quarrels could embed themselves strongly into a wooden fence. Like if you wanted to, you know, stationary aim it at someone,
it seems it could be used as a weapon.
I think here, Your Honor, we need to look to the question of intent. Again, going back to State v. Coburn, that pen was certified as a deadly weapon, taking into the into account the actions of the user and the intent of the user.
Are you talking about purposely or knowingly?
Both. Ms. Hood did not have the intention to use it as a weapon of any fashion, whether in self-defense or otherwise, and she also did not ever use it as a weapon. And so it's very different from State v. Coburn, and I think your question just goes to the intent, which Ms. Hood did not have.
You're saying that she just used it to, had it just to show to her friend Julie?
Yes, she just had it to show it to her friend. She never took it outside of her house with the intent to use it as a weapon or a deadly weapon. Your Honors, for the aforementioned reasons, the appellant respectfully requests that the lower court's decision be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you. Please feel free.
Good afternoon. My name is Krishma Walker. My code is C4. I'll be arguing for the respondent and representing the state of Buckeye. Finally, I'll be addressing the constitutional question. May it please the court. Your Honors, this is a case that focuses on the Fourth Amendment and its protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. Now, consistent with the Fourth Amendment is what the Supreme Court of the United States held in Terry v. Ohio, which is that even if an officer does not have probable cause to arrest a person, they still may in fact stop a person if there is reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. So to determine this, first, the court should notice that the defense has not challenged that a warrant has not been issued. Therefore, the court should focus solely, instead of the burden of probable cause, on the burden of reasonable suspicion. And this court should find in favor of the appellee for the following two reasons. One, there was an informant, and that informant delivered a highly reliable tip, one such the state contends qualifies as an informant citizen. And secondly, even regardless of the nature of the tip, whether it's an informant citizen or an anonymous informant, the police corroboration conducted by the officer was sufficient grounds to justify reasonable suspicion.
What was the corroboration?
Yes, Your Honor. Under the totality of circumstances, those factors being the alcoholic odor, things such as Hood looking dangerous, the bag being pointed out as a threat, Hood identified by name, Hood wearing leather jacket, all these factors a police officer could have corroborated.
Three of those factors are similar to saying you're wearing a blue tie and a dark gray jacket. I mean, does that make it corroboration?
Right,
yeah.
Your Honor.
It does not seem to be those have to do with a potential incipient crime.
Your Honor, and I agree with that hypothetical. Let's say there was just an odor of alcohol. In that situation, just the odor in itself wouldn't be characterized as reasonable suspicion. In actuality, we have a tip that provides a multitude of factors, and upon further police corroboration, we have a police officer who's noticing suspicious behavior. We're noticing Hood's eyes flitting about the crowd. We're noticing Hood looking for a place to escape. We're noticing Hood carrying the bag in a suspicious way, closing the open bag closed against her body. So all of these factors contribute to strong police corroboration.
Well, but when the police officer heard the shout out and then cried out strongly, "Where's Kat?" and the crowd kind of parted, and there he was facing her. Is that the way police perform corroboration, or do they first go and talk to the person making the claim so that they have the right questions to ask to do that corroboration?
Right, Your Honor. And I agree that in today's case, the circumstances aren't perfect, but what we see is that first, there was an informant who gave some definable characteristics as to Hood, identifying Hood by name and so forth, and other factors. But more importantly, what the officer observed which is Hood's suspicious behavior, frantic behavior, and then immediately upon stopping her, the scent of alcohol, alcoholic odor. All these factors indicate a strong basis for reason.
Wouldn't the suspicious behavior, I mean, it seems to me the suspicious behavior is looking a little bit spooked, as it were, but if you just had someone yell out, hey, I bet you she's got a gun, and then the policeman's walking toward you, any normal 18-year-old finding themselves the target of what's probably a taunt might look a little bit squirrely or suspicious. I mean, that's kind of after the fact. And it seems to me, wouldn't the suspicious behavior need to occur beforehand or
yes, Your
leading
Honor.
To that?
So what the state would contend is, sure, in that hypothetical, it may very well be likely that reasonable suspicion is not met. What the state contends, however, is that through the totality of circumstances under Malmy v. Wisner, through the informant clearly yelling the tip, through clearly pointing out Hood by name, identifying the leather jacket or the leather that Hood was wearing, pointing out Hood as being dangerous, all of these factors in the totality, even if we were to perhaps split these factors one by one, they wouldn't guarantee reasonable suspicion.
Compare this to Tidwell. In that case, the police officer, when the individual said, hey, stop that woman, she's drunk, the police officer had a reason to believe that that person knew. That person was in the store with the intoxicated individual. But here, what did the police officer know about the person who shouted this tip? Did they know that this tipster had any interaction with Kat at all before yelling this out?
Your Honor, the answer would be no. The officer did not know if there would have been interaction with the informant and Hood before. But what Tidwell does say is that in Tidwell specifically, there was no attempt to conceal his identity, and that is not necessary. And furthermore, an informant's unidentified status does not necessarily extinguish all indicia. Well,
in this case, it was shouted from a crowd. So shouldn't we consider that an attempt to conceal the identity, that the person didn't stand up amongst the crowd and say, I, this person in the crowd, think this is happening, is just anonymous because it's just one of many faces?
Of course, Your Honor, and I agree that the circumstances are not specific, but it's stronger to assume that because picture the reality of a grocery store, for example. It's highly unlikely that there's a person who's just going to yell out a person by name, identify them as dangerous, identify alcoholic odor, and identify the bag as a threat. All of these kind of characteristics combined in a tip together and yelled them out in the middle of a packed grocery store, this would constitute a tip as compared to just a measly taunt, for example.
So it doesn't matter that the remark, the tip, was not directed. The tip in this case was just somebody shouting out. In Tidwell, it was a person going directly to a police officer and saying, "She's been drinking."
Two things, Your Honor. First, what the state would contend is that, first, the officer was actually stationed near the exit. It's just as likely that this informant probably saw the officer. But the more important argument would be that let's assume that this was a taunt. And what the officer would still have to do is that there was enough information to go off of, the alcoholic odor, Hood being identified by name, the bag being pointed out as a threat, all those factors. Those conditions show that an officer had a reasonable suspicion and could have pursued that further investigation.
So remind me then, in the facts, the police officer was stationed at the entrance?
I believe what the facts of the case were was the police officer was stationed near the entrance, Your Honor.
Near the entrance.
But the police officer heard this statement, she's packing in that bag, count on it. Now, if the declarant would have said she's packing in that bag and stopped, but when they say count on it, doesn't that suggest some speculation?
Your Honor, I would contend, I'm not a linguistics master, but what I would say is that first, the nature of how it was yelled contributes to the intent. The fact that it was yelled, perhaps trying to reach someone, and moreover, the fact that the informant identify the bag as a threat, regardless of the count on it, still contributes to a strong indicia of reliability.
I mean, doesn't it seem like it's more taunting than anything else? I mean, the phrase, wow, cat's looking awful dangerous in that leather jacket, seems to me more like a snide, taunting comment than an attempt to identify a potential criminal situation.
Your Honor, and I agree, but what we have to take in mind is that this is not just a citizen stopping another citizen. This is a trained police officer, and that brings me to my next point, is that
I've got one more question for you.
It kind of was overlapping, so I will wait and maybe add to it when you're done.
Of course, Your Honor. So this is a case where we have a trained police officer, Your Honor, and in fact, where this police officer is using his own observations. And so perhaps let's consider that there was a taunt. The police officer still had information that was concerning, the fact of alcoholic odor, the fact of the bag being pointed as a threat. So under those factors, the police officer still could have still used his trained experience to deliver what he thought was a reasonable suspicion to stop a person.
Counsel, I see how he might want to investigate even a taunt, but what gives him a constitutional right to search a bag based on a taunt? I think there's differences. Yes, I agree he should investigate, but going over and seeing a young individual that she might smell about alcohol, but there's nothing inherently dangerous about this situation. What crosses the line? Where's that the thing that makes it reasonable to actually make her dump out her bag?
Right, Your Honor. The line that the state contends has been crossed is the information that the police officer has corroborated. And so there are multiple factors. First, alcoholic odor, which we've covered. But secondly, the manner in which Hood was acting. Hood was looking suspicious. In fact, she was looking for a place to escape. Her eyes were flitting about the crowd. And secondly, and more importantly, the bag. Hood was closing the open mouth of the bag against her body. Hood's knuckles were whitening on the strap of the bag. And the officer, who's a trained officer, took a moment to apprehend the situation and noticed these factors. So aside from the informant's tip, he also had the observation of alcoholic odor immediately after. He also had the factor of suspicious behavior, looking for a place to escape. He also had the factor of the bag. So we need to consider those in the totality. Now, another case that the appellant brings up is Florida v. J.L. And there are a couple of factors that differentiate Florida v. J.L. from the case before us today. In Florida v. J.L., there was an anonymous caller that the Supreme Court held did not constitute a probable cause to search a person's bag because there was a mere identification. So in Florida v. J.L., we see an anonymous caller from an anonymous location who could not be identified. In our case today, we have an informant who was within the grocery store, yelled the tip. We have an informant who was capable of being known. That strengthens the indicia.
But in Florida v. J.L., that tipster said, this guy at this bus stop has a gun. There's not much ambiguity in that. Whereas cat's smelling like booze and I bet she's packing is a lot more ambiguous.
Right, Your Honor. And let's assume under that hypothetical that that happened. Perhaps the factors wouldn't contribute to reasonable suspicion, but what does solidify that is the fact that the police officer had information to corroborate and did corroborate. In Florida v. J.L., there was no corroboration because the informant merely provided an identification of a black man standing at a bus stop with a plaid shirt. That is not.
Is there any case that you have in your brief or maybe cited by the appellants where a individual was considered an informant who didn't actually go up to an officer to inform them or make a call to an officer to inform them? Because it was shouted out in a room. And I think all the cases so far I've heard is where someone reaches out purposefully to law enforcement to inform them of a potentially dangerous situation.
Right, Your Honor. And based on the evidence that we have at hand, I don't believe there is a case that's strongly relating to that. The case I would point two would be Adams v. Williams, where there was a tip supplied moments before the police interaction. And in fact, this informant offered immediately verifiable evidence. I would argue in this case before us today, there were similar factors. First, the tip coming immediately before, an exact relay of the circumstances as they were occurring, a verbally given tip, a tip that was, I believe I already said it, but in person. So those strengthened the indicia.
To follow up on my colleague's question, what factors would the anonymous tipster in this case know that there was even a police officer? Are there facts that would suggest that this person who shouted this out knew a police officer would hear the shouts and that it wasn't just directed to other students?
Right, Your Honor. First, I would say the nature of how the tip was given, the yell, probably indicates it was perhaps trying to reach an enforcement person. But secondly, and the more important point, the officer was stationed near the grocery store. It's very well likely that the informant saw this person as he or she was walking in. And the third point that I would bring up is that let's assume that the informant didn't know that there was an officer. There is still the possibility of face-to-face interaction by an officer, further investigation by an officer. All these factors contribute to a person not yelling out a tip unless there's strong indicia of reliability to provide that tip.
Counsel, how does someone look dangerous? I mean, they said looking dangerous in that leather, and it was, do we look at that portion of the statement only for the fact that the police could corroborate she was wearing a leather jacket, or is there something legal or illegal about looking dangerous?
Right, Your Honor. And the standard I would say is if a police officer were to just stop someone for looking dangerous, that would not constitute reasonable suspicion. What does constitute reasonable suspicion is the factors we look to under the totality of circumstances. And so, sure, dangerous is not enough to constitute reasonable suspicion, but the other factors indicated by the informant do give that impression. And so, for those following reasons, the highly reliable tip and the police corroboration, I respectfully request that the lower court's decision be affirmed, and that Hood's conviction be affirmed as well.
Just
thank
one
you,
moment.
Your Honor.
Do you want to ask the question and follow up?
Okay. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I proceed?
Yes, you may.
Your Honors, my name is Emerson Katz, and my code is C3. I will be arguing for the statutory side for the state of Buckeye. Your Honors, may it please the court. The operative words in the Buckeye statute, BC 2923.11, state that it is a criminal act to carry or knowingly possess a deadly weapon. It defines a deadly weapon as hazardous if it is capable of inflicting death and adapted or used as a deadly weapon. Furthermore, under statute BC 2923.12, no person shall possess or carry a concealed weapon. In the case of State of Buckeye v. Cat Hood, the appellant's crossbow was capable of inflicting death and therefore meets the definition of a deadly weapon.
How was it adapted to be a deadly weapon?
Yes, Your Honor. So the appellant's crossbow was designed with a steel cable rather than a piece of string, and the enhanced durability and strength of the steel cable would allow for the arrow to be shot with more power than just an ordinary string.
So do you think that design feature was an adaptation to make that 4-inch crossbow a deadly weapon?
Yes, Your Honor. And while Kat did not adapt the weapon herself, the steel cable still presented an issue as it...
I just look at it, since it was sold as a toy, there's probably not a lot of things found at Toys R Us that are adapted to be a deadly weapon.
Yes,
so
Your
I was
Honor.
Just kind of wondering what the adaptations were here.
Yes, Your Honor. So additionally, as we know, the packaging of the crossbow had targeted the product towards an adult audience, and it even suggested using the crossbow to fire toothpicks, which the appellant, Ms. Hood, tried. But she received more gratification when she took the crossbow with the steel-tipped arrows outside, and they for more serious practice. They embedded themselves, the arrows embedded themselves in the fence from a distance of 20 feet deep into the fence. The fact that these quarrels buried themselves so deep into such fence also conveyed that they could easily be buried into one's flesh. This could have potential lethal effects, including infection, excessive bleeding, or even death itself.
Counsel, was there any testimony related to those potential dangers from this crossbow at trial?
No, Your Honor. However, Ms. Hood did originally plead to these charges.
Isn't death the only consequence that could, as I see the definition of deadly weapon, death is the only consequence. It's not a consequence of even a serious injury.
It yes,
would have
Your
to
Honor.
Be capable of inflicting death.
Yes, Your Honor. But despite Ms. Hood seeing the effects of the arrows being shot at the wooden fence, she still chose to employ at least one of these arrows in her bag, which conveys here that she made an active choice to employ these arrows or carry these arrows with her in her purse.
How likely does it have to be that you would cause death? Is it enough that a lucky shot might cause death if it is aimed in a specific spot? Or is it enough that any time you get shot with it, it is going to cause death?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not an expert on like aiming or anything like that, but obviously, like similarly, a gun would be able to be shot and someone could still be injured and not die from it. So it's similar in that sense.
But she didn't really plead guilty. She pled no contest, so she wasn't contesting the factual statements, but she didn't actually admit guilt. And this was a question of suppression, so it was appealed after the no contest plea. So can we really rely on what you said a moment ago about that she pled guilty?
Yes, Your Honor, I misspoke. I meant to say no contest, and I apologize for that.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
Yeah. The appellant has argued that because the crossbow was on the smaller side, that it was less capable of being a weapon and was only meant to be a novelty toy. However, in State v. Huber, despite the crossbow being, the test showed that despite the crossbow being 4 inches long, no item, no matter how small or commonplace, can be safely disregarded for its capacity to cause death when it is wielded with the requisite intent and force. Here we have seen Ms. Hood stated that it would be comfortable to carry with her in her purse during the nighttime.
Counsel, does it, when you say wielded with the requisite intent, isn't that wielded at the time of the crime? So she wasn't wielding it when it was found. So do we look at intent from a week before when she put it in her bag, that she thought maybe it might stop a burglar, but then reconsidered? I mean, where, at what point do we look at the intent?
Yes, Your Honor. So as stipulated in the case packet, we can look at the facts provided to us from the week prior, and also the facts given to us when Hood was in the crowded grocery store. Ms. Hood became paranoid in the grocery store when she felt the crossbow pressing through the fabric of her shoulder bag, displaying that she was cognizant of this crossbow in her bag, and it made her feel anxious that it was there, as stipulated in the packet.
Right, but is that really criminally suspicious behavior? It seems more of, you know, there's maybe no question that a crossbow with metal arrows has some dangerous aspect to it, but not intending to use it as a weapon. But that might make her feel nervous, but probably not nervous to a degree to incite a police search. I mean, might that be an explanation for her behavior that you're now arguing was suspicious enough to believe a crime might have been committed?
Yes, Your Honor. It can be interpreted that she could have just felt anxious, as she's just an 18-year-old teenager that could be searched. However, it can also be reasonably inferred that she felt paranoid because she saw the weapon inflict damage into a wooden fence a week prior.
Well, I guess what I'm getting to is that we do have an 18-year-old high school student who is being approached by a police officer, which is going to create some type of nervousness just purely by the situation itself. So wouldn't that be something a policeman should take into account in determining whether it's suspicious or whether it's just a high school student being nervous about suddenly becoming the focus of a police officer?
Yes, Your Honor. In the case before us today, Ms. Hood, the officer at the store most likely had underwent training and had been placed in the store before. It can be reasonably inferred that the officer had been placed in a similar situation before, or at least had underwent training to be able to differentiate emotions.
Well, I guess what I'm kind of getting into is like a police officer that stops someone for a traffic violation. And for those of us that have been around for a while, have maybe had that experience once or twice, you know, getting kind of used to it. But the first time you're stopped when you're 16 or 17 driving, you might look pretty, you know, agitated or nervous about it. So shouldn't that be something that the police officer would kind of take into account as a natural thing you might find in an 18-year-old?
Yes, Your Honor. And in the stipulated facts, we don't know what the officer was thinking. We can only see an interpretation of the facts before us.
I have a question about, I think even if we take it that she was nervous because she thought that this crossbow was a weapon, I think that was where you were going. Does it matter what her thoughts are? I mean, if it seems to me that it would either be a deadly weapon or it's not a deadly weapon, setting aside maybe using a commonplace item like a pen. So does it matter at all, or why would it matter that she was nervous and thought it, or potentially thought it was a weapon? Because to me, it seems like it is an objective standard. It is or it isn't.
Yes. Ms. Hood, stated previously, she could have been anxious because she had seen it inflict damage into a wooden fence. Did that answer your question? All right.
But a fact finder could look at the situation where she wasn't popular, she was not popular at school, and so she was probably a little bit self-conscious, defensive in the first place. And if the officer was a trained police officer, I mean, you would think that the people skills would kind of pick up on that just from her appearance.
So, what was the question?
I guess I'm just asking you in relation to your argument, you know, whether any of that should be taken into account.
I can
elucidate a little bit more, because you know, some have said here when the officer approached her, but the officer didn't approach her until this was shouted out in the crowd in the food court. Go ahead.
Sorry. We don't know how, like, these, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is we don't know, like, if everyone in the crowd thought that she was weak, like, or, like, misinterpreted or misunderstood, as the packet said. We can only look at the stipulated facts at hand. We don't know if everyone in the crowd thought that of her.
Right, and I guess what I'm saying is when she kind of clutched out her bag, and this goes to the concealed part, when she clutched out her bag and realized that it was in her bag, do you think some of her fear was because of her relationship with her peers? If she was a popular girl, would she have thought anything about the fact that this crossbow was in her bag? Because it's so tiny, it's a novelty.
Yes, Your Honor. It can be reasonably inferred that because we don't know how Ms. Hood responded to these accusations against herself. Like, we don't know if she, like, we know that she was aware that people thought of her like that, but we don't know if she internalized those thoughts. So, yes, she did have the crossbow in her bag, but the question at hand today is whether the weapon was capable of inflicting death, which I already proved with the details provided from the fence, and whether it was ready at hand, which I can get into right now.
Go right ahead.
All right. Statute BC 292312 states that no person can possess a ready-at-hand weapon. In the case before us today, the appellant was capable of loading the crossbow any time as she possessed at least one steel-tipped fletched arrow in the same bag. This case relates to State v. Davis. In State v. Davis, Davis possessed an unloaded gun and a loaded magazine on the driver's floorboard. The firearm was not loaded, but next to the firearm, in a closed case, was a loaded magazine. The court held that Davis was possessing the gun ready at hand, and as the weapon and magazine could be readily picked up, put together, and used. Likewise, in the case before us today, Hood simply had to open the bag, remove the weapon, and load it. The appellant pointed to State v. Miller for a proximity test. However, as I stated previously, Ms. Hood's crossbow was so close to her body that she could feel it pressing through the fabric.
Don't we
bag.
Have an issue with, okay, now you say the case you just relied on, but then there was also State v. Beasley where it was a gun where you clearly had to use two hands to assemble it, you know, put the rod in, put the barrel in, and I think the fact that it took two hands to access it was determinative to the court as being not ready at hand. And I would think it would be almost impossible to shoot a crossbow with one hand very effectively.
Yes, Your Honor. Also in State v. Beasley, the revolver was not immediately operable as you had to put multiple parts together, or more parts than what Ms. Hood would have had to do. Therefore, it wasn't ready at hand. However, Hood could just as easily reach into her shoulder bag in which the other items had... may I finish my sentence
Please, go
and
ahead.
Conclude? Okay, thank you. The other items were not made of nearly the same material as the crossbow, and the crossbow could be easily felt, and the arrows could be easily felt amidst the other items. And therefore, it could be considered... It was considered... The state contends that it was ready at hand. For the foregoing reasons, we respectfully request that the court affirm the lower court's conviction.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal.
May I proceed?
Yes.
Madam Chief Justice, Your Honors, may it please the court. Ms. Hood was a teenager confronted by a police officer. There is a very obvious difference in power, and she would very reasonably be nervous about that, causing her behavior as a reaction to the police officer's actions. As to the content of the shouts, they were not predictive and did not show any inside knowledge of criminal activity, which is the standard in JL. They pointed out observable characteristics like her clothes or the way she smelled. Also, Ms. Hood was in a crowd of her classmates at the time, so we can reasonably assume that her classmates would know her name. So the fact that the person shouting knew her name does not give that person any sort of personal knowledge about her or the crimes that she may have committed. There are also no facts in the stipulated record to show that the person who shouted knew that the police officer was close by. They didn't address the tip to the police officer. They did not go to the police officer and tell it to them directly. As well, the officer's training and experience is also not stipulated in the facts. We have no idea if this police officer was ever stationed in that location, so we don't know if it was normal for that officer to be there, and we don't know that officer's experience with teenagers and run-ins with the law.
Let's say we agree with you on the Fourth Amendment question. Do we need to reach the statutory question?
I think at that point, the evidence can be suppressed, and so therefore we don't even need to move on to the statutory.
Likewise, if we determine that it isn't a deadly weapon, do we need to address the Fourth Amendment question?
I think this would also be an either or. I think we could prove that Ms. Hood's Fourth Amendment rights were violated and suppress the evidence, or we could prove that she didn't violate the statute, in which I believe today we have proven both. While it can be argued that the crossbow was capable of inflicting death, it still does not meet either of the other requirements of the Buckeye Deadly Weapons Statute, which are needed for it to be certified as a deadly weapon in a court of law. In State v. Huber, again, the case with the mop head, excuse me, can I say a closing statement, please?
Yes, you certainly may.
Thank you. Your Honors, we respectfully request that the lower court's decision be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. So now it's our chance. We've written down our scores. We've submitted those. I think they're double checking, especially our addition. And we want a chance just to talk with the four of you. And congratulations on making it this far. I'm Justice Jennifer Bruner of the Ohio Supreme Court. And I'm very pleased to be here today. And feeling very hopeful about the future of law if you all choose to go in that direction. So, and my colleagues here will also give you some comments as well. I can't read your name tags from here. So is that Rachel?
Yes.
Okay, and?
Eliza.
Okay. You two had, I think you probably had the easier side of the case to argue. And you had a good grasp of the facts. Even with tough questions, you didn't let that rattle you. And I think you presented yourself confidently. Rachel, if you ever speak with a court reporter in the room, they'll probably ask you to slow down just a little bit. But that's just your head. You had everything up there. It was very, very good. And I could follow easily. And Eliza, that's really tough to do the rebuttal. And when you ran out of time, that was excellent way to handle it. You respected the time. You said, may have a minute to wrap up. And that was the perfect way to do it. And I think all of you, when questions were asked of you, I like the way you said, yes, Your Honor, because that sort of showed some deference to the court, that you acknowledged that it had a question, plus it gave you a minute to organize your thoughts to answer the question. I think all of you did that. Let me see your names again. Oh, Emerson, right, and
Krish.
And Krish. I think you two had the harder case to argue. Krish, you were very relaxed up there. I could actually see you as a future prosecutor at some point, or defense attorney, either way. Emerson, you were a little bit nervous, and I apologize that one of my questions was a little bit off the wall about her being popular or not, and I didn't tie it as well into why she clutched her bag and was nervous about having the crossbow in her bag when she remembered it was there. But you did just fine with that. I think you all were, you knew your facts, you knew your case law, you knew how it applied, and I think you all argued very effectively. And congratulations on a job well done for all four of you.
Go next, Tiffany.
Sure. My name is Tiffany Carwile. I am a litigation attorney here in Columbus, Ohio, with the law firm of Arnold and Clifford. I've done my fair share of appellate argument. It's actually one of my favorite things to do, but I don't do it as much as I would like. But I want to thank you guys for all the time and effort you put into preparing for today. I'm also on the Moot Court Case Committee and the Rules Committee, so I appreciate being able to see what you do with the case that we come up with in the fall of the year. It's always very rewarding to be able to do the judging and see the great work that the students and today you guys put forward. So thank you. I really appreciate that. And that You guys did an amazing job. You should be very proud of yourselves. One of the critiques that I would have just moving forward, I think just be careful of language when you're answering questions. Stuff like, I guess, I believe. I used to do that in my writing, and I had a professor say, well, I don't really care what you believe. Tell me what is actually there. And the same thing would apply for an argument. I don't necessarily care what your belief is. What does the case say? What does the law say? So just be a little bit cognizant of word choice when arguing. That can be hard. You're in the moment, and it's hard to prepare for stuff like that. But great job, good job.
All right. Well, I think he told me to go bounce back and forth.
No. My name is Jim Satola. I began my career as a law clerk to a United States District Judge, and I spent 20 years with a worldwide law firm in the litigation department, and I'm now somewhat concluding my career as a law clerk to a United States District Judge. And similar to Tiffany, I'm on the problem writing committee, so it is always kind of rewarding is that we first get together like in October to think about, well, what should the problem be? And then it goes through a various process and culminates 6 months later in seeing students really address that case and understand it and bring it into fruition. So that makes it fun for us. And I just want to say, too, I commend all four of you for a terrific oral argument. I mean, it was very clear that you knew the facts of the case, the important points to make the case, the relevant case law, and how to respond to arguments effectively and well. I just really have to say that it makes it very rewarding for us to be here at the end of Friday afternoon to see such a well-presented case. I just want to thank not only each of the advocates at the tables, but also the advisors, friends, and classmates that are behind the camera supporting you too. So. Thank you for a well-argued case.
Sam?
I'm Sam Peterson. I'm a Deputy Solicitor General at the Ohio Attorney General's Office. And so in that role, I argue in front of the Ohio Supreme Court somewhat frequently. So I've been
a lot.
In front of your position, even in your position, arguing in front of Justice Bruner on many occasions. And
I'm nice to him.
Always. Unfailingly. I will say you all did an amazing job. You did as well or even maybe dare say better than some advocates I've seen argue in other courts. And so I think that for all of you, that's really something to be said. And you know, one thing I'll tell you is this happens to me after every argument. I go home and I think of something that I wish I would have said. So it's going to happen to you today, probably on your way home. Don't feel bad about it. It happens to all of us. There's always that moment. You're like, I wish I would have said this differently. So don't let that take away from the excellent job you did. The one thing I will say, I'm not going to give you all individual comments, though I could go on forever. The one thing I will comment on is, Liza, I had asked you a question in your case in chief about, well, are you giving up the affirmative defense argument? And you said, yep, and you moved right on. Sometimes knowing what to give up and what you're willing to give up is one of the hardest things for an attorney to do. And the fact that you were confident in that, I think, is really, that's a commendable thing. Again, the fact that I gave that comment does not detract from the rest of you. I just want to be respectful of everyone's time. Fantastic job. Congratulations. And I echo the sentiments of everyone.
Right. I'm Steve Dotterman. I'm attorney at Fifth Third Bank, specifically a regional fiduciary executive working with trust officers, interpreting wills, interpreting trust agreements, and interpreting statutes. That's why I probably asked more questions regarding the statutory part of the case, just analyzing the statute here that I had in front of me. To me, it was a very fascinating part of today. I would echo everything that the other justices have said this afternoon regarding pace, regarding professionalism, which I thought was just excellent. The professionalism and civility are very important to us today and to OCLRE specifically. And we just want to thank you for presenting all of this to us today in this manner.
So in short, great job.
Thank you, judges. I appreciate it. And congratulations again on competing in the 2022 Moot Court State Competition. Moot Court is a very rigorous program, so everyone here should be proud of themselves for what they have achieved. Next, I'd like to make sure that we thank several people and groups for making this competition possible. First and foremost, thank you to our teachers and advisors. Your guidance and support are invaluable. Thank you to the volunteers who judged today or evaluated briefs. We definitely could not do this without you. Thank you to my colleagues at OCLRE for their unwavering support. And thank you to the Ohio Channel for filming our championship round. And finally, thank you to the OCLRE sponsors, Supreme Court of Ohio, Ohio Attorney General, Ohio State Bar Association, and the ACLU of Ohio Foundation. In addition, thanks to the Ohio State Bar Foundation for their financial support of the program. With that, we do have several teams and individual students to recognize for their achievements in the Moot Court program this year. First, I would want to acknowledge our four semifinalist teams and their students. Congratulations to Danville Team Blue, Upper Arlington Teams Glenn and Humphrey, and Mason Team Tangerines. Is there a representative from Danville or Mason here? All right, that's okay. We'll send the awards later. Next, I will recognize individual students with our Outstanding Advocate Awards. If I call your name, if you don't mind, please coming up. My colleague, Brian Suskey, will be handing your awards to you. Third place, Best Advocate Petitioner, goes to Minda Bates. Third place, Best Advocate Respondent, goes to Ryan Lucas. Second place, Best Advocate Petitioner, goes to Rachel Leach. Second place Best Advocate Respondent goes to Guhan Krishnan. First place Best Advocate Petitioner goes to Matthew Doran. First place Best Advocate Respondent goes to Minda Bates. Congratulations, students. Finally, we have two extremely talented teams before us today in the championship round, both of which deserve our full acknowledgement. Congratulations, Upper Arlington. You both are leaving with a trophy today. So first and foremost, we do have Upper Arlington High School Team Glenn. Teammates include Jiwon Sun, Matthew Doran, Emerson Katz, and Chris Milwalker. And additionally, our second UA team, Team Humphrey, with Eliza Wunderlich, Rachel Leach, Nathan Varda, and Danny Petronella. Congratulations to both teams on your hard work, preparation, and performance. So now let's go ahead and announce our competition winner. The 2022 Moot Court State Champion is Upper Arlington Team Humphrey. If you want to come up and accept your trophies, the entire team, we do have medals, so all of you, please join us. And again, due recognition and congratulations to our 2022 Moot Court State runner-up, Upper Arlington Team Glenn. Trophy and medals.
So you get the bigger one.
Congratulations again to everyone. Have a wonderful evening and safe travels home, and we hope to see you back in 2023. Thank you.